Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On today's show, we'll be speaking with musician David Gray. The chart-topping singer-songwriter is back with a new album, Gold in a Brass Age, and we'll be hearing all about it later.
We'll also be taking a whistle-stop tour around some of Europe's standout modernist architectural treasures, courtesy of designer and author Steffi Arazzi.
And we'll be learning about the work of celebrated British photojournalist Don McCullen, whose agenda-setting images of conflict and urban life are now on show at Tate Britain in London with curator Aicha Meras.
Plus, Carlotta Rabello will be looking ahead to next week's news today, and we'll enjoy some great music too here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Fernando, it's a great pleasure to be here in the Monocle Weekly presenter's chairs with you once again. But we should start with some sad reflections, of course, from the week. The world of fashion, and, well, the world, mourning the passing of the great Karl Lagerfeld. One of those, we probably will not see his like again.
Absolutely not. You know, people say, oh, the legendary actor died and here and so. But Karl Lagerfeld, I mean, even if you don't like him, you respect. I mean, he's amazing career as a designer. He's been at Chanel since 1983. It's incredible because even when I, you know, I read the, you know, the Spanish, the Brazilian papers, it was on the front page of every single major broadsheet, you know, the next day after his death. So it is quite shocking. And it was interesting to rewatch the interview that our very own editor-in-chief did with Karl back in 2014. And I mean, he's a funny guy. I mean, okay, some people might not agree with his views and everything, but he made us laugh and he's a very talented designer.
Well, and one of the things talking to Tyler this past week about Karl that he admired so much was exactly that, this very forthright. He certainly, it's an understatement to say he wasn't afraid of upsetting people. He spoke his mind, and there's probably not enough people who are willing to be a bit spiky, a bit outrageous, a bit confrontational. You know, everything is so sanitized. Everyone's worrying about what is going to be said on social media and all the rest. He was certainly someone who spoke his mind and knew his own mind better than anyone.
Absolutely. So I think, yeah, the fashion world, I mean, the world, will probably miss a little bit of Lagerfeld in their lives.
Well, we'll try and bring just a tiny measure of his spiky attitude to proceedings on today's Monocle Weekly. We've got a few great guests, haven't we, Faye, to meet. I'm looking forward to chatting with David Gray, who's a bit of a legend in the music scene here in this country.
I mean, Babylon is a classic. I mean, we have to admit it, right?
And we're going back almost, well, when the album first came out, basically 20 years, which is extraordinary to think. So I'm looking forward to talking to David a little later. I'm looking forward, Fernando, to looking ahead to next week's news today. Who's that coming up over the horizon?
Carlotta Rabello.
And here she is, Carlotta.
Hello.
Welcome.
Let's start with the Oscars, of course, happening later tonight. And if I'm going to be here sitting in front of Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and you as well, Tom, of course, we have to mention the Oscars.
Well, and certainly in the last few iterations, it seems with the Oscars, Fernando, you and I have spoken about this, that it's almost as much about who's presenting it or the politics behind the awards than the actual winners. And yet there are some interesting things to look out for. Netflix has made a big play to try and get one of their films recognised, a brilliant film, which I saw, Roma. Is that the most interesting dynamic, or is there a particular winner? A lot of people talking about long-serving actors who haven't ever won, Glenn Close, this sort of thing. What are you looking out for?
A lot of interesting big blockbusters in the Best Picture category as well, because I think in recent years we had a lot of indies like winning. Perhaps you might have Roma again, but you know, Black Panther as Best Picture.
Yes,
that's remarkable,
it's
right?
It's the first time a superhero movie, an action movie like that, is nominated for the Best Picture. And there are, of course, a couple of other mentions of, you know, not only actresses and actors that should have been recognized long before, but you know, you have like Lady Gaga, for example, the first time in a movie and she's nominated. And it's just interesting to see how there is this ongoing attempt, at least by the Academy, to recognize people in different parts of the cinematic field. Now, of course, we need to mention that even though there's been efforts to diversify these awards, the Best Director category is still all male. And while some people might say step by step, it's still a huge thing that the Best Director category is only male nominees. Next, looking ahead to tomorrow, Monday, here in the UK, it will be the first day of the junk food advertising ban on TfL, the Transport for London's bus, tram, overground, tube, everywhere. So this is a measure that Sadiq Khan, the London's mayor, announced back in November, and it comes into effect tomorrow, that any advertising related to junk food will be banned from all across these platforms. Now, of course, there was concerns that there might be some loopholes. You know, if you just get, you know, a green background with a McDonald's logo, you're not technically advertising junk food, but a company that does that. And that is banned as well. The only way companies, fast food chains, can get around it is if they advertise their healthy snacks. So a McDonald's salad, that's good. I don't know if there's healthy something somewhere else, that's fine. But I just wonder how effective it's going to be and if it's actually going to be noticeable.
I feel sad, actually. I mean, I do like the McDonald's advertising with a good burger.
You're a great libertarian, Fernando. I think, listen, if we concede and acknowledge and support the idea that advertising works, then it's got to be a good thing to keep junk food away from impressionable minds, kids waiting at bus stops on their way to and from school. I broadly support it. I know what you mean, Faye. I have some reservations about being too nanny state, but I think in this instance, I think it's probably a good idea.
Yeah, and what prompted this decision back at the end of last year was when a report came out by Public Health England that said that over 35%, I think 37% of 10 to 11-year-olds here in this country are obese or overweight. And of course, as Tom just said, advertising on, you know, your daily commute, on your routine, does impact that. And now I wish I had pinpointed that this date of Monday earlier in my calendar, because I'm actually quite curious to see if there has been a surge in junk food advertising over the last couple of months since the ban is now coming into effect. But I don't know if it will be that noticeable on your day-to-day life, at least not for me. I know, we know Fernando's going to be sad, but at least not for me.
I'll be very sad. So what's the final story, Carlotta?
The final story, and that's why I said at the beginning of this look ahead that we were going to end on a sad note. Aww. Because it's yet again the second meaningful vote on Brexit happening on Wednesday.
I thought we were going to get through a whole news look ahead without the B word.
I'm sorry. It's the B word. I can't not utter that word anymore. It's just part of my day-to-day communications. But yeah, the second meaningful vote for the government's EU withdrawal agreement is happening, is expected to happen on Wednesday. If it goes like last time, it might be delayed. Now, of course, this follows all the important votes we saw earlier in the month on the 14th of February. And there are rumours that some Remain supporting ministers are reportedly considering to resign so that they can support an amendment that wants to extend Article 50, which at this point seems like the most sensible thing to do because the clock is ticking down to the 29th of March and 22:59 p.m. at that time. But the truth is, no one really knows what's going to happen if any of the amendments to extend Article 50 or to allow that the UK won't leave without a deal will go through. And the way things have happened and unfolded over the past couple of months just shows that we really can't predict this one until it actually happens.
That is your week ahead. Carlotta Rovello, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. Carlotta, see you again soon. Up next, we'll be hearing from David Gray. Stay tuned. Musician David Gray's breakout album White Ladder hit number one back in 2001. I can scarcely believe it's that long ago. Its now ubiquitous hits such as Babylon and This Year's Love helped it stay in the charts for years.
That balance of heartfelt, reflective and experimental songwriting alongside a savvy pop sensibility continues on his latest record, Gold in a Brass Age. And David is here to talk about it. But first, let's hear a bit of his latest single, A Tight Ship. Better than to know myself. Let fear be damned. Let love be well. To sing like no one sees. A little bit of A Tight Ship there by David Gray. He joins us now in the studio. David, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you. Hello.
Were you chuckling there as we read your intro?
Did you not like? I was trying to strike the appropriate pose. I was trying to be pop savvy and all the other things.
Do you think you have a savvy pop sensibility? I don't know. I think you definitely do.
I've got a melodic sensibility, so I think that whatever kind of music I make, I want it to reach out and connect. I don't want to hide in a sort of obscure gesture. It has to reach out and make a connection. That's what I'm hoping. So I think if that's a pop sensibility, then I definitely have that. I think the influence of people that I grew up listening to in terms of what my dad might have listened to, the Beatles or Elton John or Bob Dylan, those things are very, very direct, that kind of music, as well as being sophisticated. So those things have gone in as deeply as the other things I've stumbled upon throughout my listening life.
David, tell us a bit more about the song A Tight Ship. I mean, first of all, I love it. It has some kind of... It's quite a sunny song, would you say that?
I think it's very upbeat. I think it has a slightly ironic twinkle in its eye. It's a strange song. It's sort of aspirational. It's about living in the moment and not caring, which is obviously something we all aspire to these days, but none of us can actually get anywhere near. So that's where the sort of slightly detached, ironic stance, if the song comes, it's a yearning for this kind of poetically complete existence that's described as the verses go by. And then at the end, it sort of has the image of diving into a mirrored pool. And suddenly you are the bird diving through the mirror into the music itself, and the song deepens and you go behind the surface, underneath the surface, and that's how the song completes itself. It proposes something and then it becomes the thing. So there's a kind of paradox at work here that sounds very sophisticated. It's basically just a very simple upbeat pop song that sort of switches modes at the end and goes half time and very sort of moody and holds a lovely sort of mantric poise, which kind of is all enveloping. So that's how I feel about it, from looking from the inside out.
It's positively poetic hearing David talk about it, so you can imagine how good the record is. I want to ask you about something that I've heard you talking about this record, David, and talking about it being a London record, your adopted home. And I think you said in a way that maybe no other record since White Ladder was. What do you mean by that? And is there something a bit... I know you said it's upbeat, but I think there's something a little melancholy about some of the tracks. And I wonder, is being in London now, are you a bit sad about some elements of sort of where the city's going, where the country's going? Or is that...
No, I just think that's just what my soul sounds like. It sounds a bit like that, wherever I am. So without getting sidetracked, the word melancholy is a bit like the word surreal. It's sort of come to me as a sort of interesting form of sad. But it's actually more complex than that. Its original derivation, it was more of a sort of specific thing. So I'm actually reading a book about it at the moment. I'm not going to sidetrack you onto that.
In a way, a good question to ask, but in a way, a bad question to ask, because you're obviously going to be much better informed than me.
I'm loaded with ideas about melancholy, but I think the...
Or nostalgia, maybe? Is there a nostalgia twinge to it?
I love being in the city, but it overwhelms me. I don't think that I'll ever leave. My wife and I are sort of firmly sort of rooted here. We've got our kids are here, they love it. We've got lots of friends. There's all the world of wonders that the city provides. It's a sort of impossible beast. I think this record, the reason I said what I said about it was because of its sonic identity and the sort of wry, detached, almost humorous reconstruction of sound. That to live in London, you have to be able to detach from it. It's overwhelming. It's sensory overload. And it's also just the crush of anonymity and bulk, juxtaposition of one thing on another. But that's also what's this incredible bloom of ideas and mishmash of things, and the way that things come racing out of the night or the day to surprise you. This is what's so exhilarating about it. The fact it tears itself down and builds itself up, but living within that. So that sort of creative principle of and sort of non-sentimental tearing down and reconstructing, which can be horrifying to witness if it's a venue you played many of your favourite shows in or whatever, and it comes down, it's gone, and there's Crossrail instead. But that's the city. It moves on. It's just how many hands built this place, and they've all just been crushed down, and it goes on like a sort of fire that sucks in the human oxygen it needs. And you're just a brief sort of sparkling in the sort of edges of it. That's how the city works. So I love that about it. I love the unknowability of it. But it's this detachment and this sense of humour that proper Londoners have. There is a community here and there is a sort of warm beating heart. Lots of people can't see it, but it's there. And it exemplified by the artwork, but also by the guy who produced my record, Ben, who lives like about 100 yards from Centrepoint in like properly in London. And he's sort of a young guy embedded in the sonic culture and the sort of recreation of this new wave of sound, who knew exactly what I meant when I said I want to chop up my music and start again. I wanted to sort of, if you want, I didn't want to just put acoustic guitar takes down. I wanted a cubist impression of what they look like. So something new, a new vista, basically. Because in London, that feels very important. It feels very important to tear down and make again. And that's a part of the creative process for anybody, I think, worth their salt. There's got to be some sort of evolution going on. This time round, in my music, it's quite pronounced. So it's also reflected in the artwork, which was a beautiful thing that chimed, that my daughter found this tattoo artist, London Boy. It took a while to get hold of him, as it is with this sort of young, sort of independent Londoners. It was a while to tune into whatever wavelength he was on. But when we did, he was super up for it. He was the sweetest guy. And I sort of passed all my tangential ideas about the imagery for each track. He did a drawing per track. And he sort of passed them through his cheeky London filter, and it just came out absolutely perfect. It's very, very unusual to give someone ideas and it comes back better than what you'd hoped. And I just took that as a sign, a bit like Brighton Rock. You cut through anywhere in this campaign, everything seems to reflect the core of the music and the central idea. And there must be something genuine and real at the centre of this thing that I've made, that can happen. So I'm taking these as good omens.
David, about the name of the album, I heard it was inspired by a short story. Can you tell us a bit more and what's your connection with that story?
Yeah, I think that's probably taking it too far. It wasn't inspired by a short story. I literally lifted the line from a short story by Raymond Carver. The story's called Blackbird Pie. It's not always easy to find. I've got a very old compilation of his short stories called Where I'm Calling From. I find short stories are a wonderful sort of default place to go when reading on tour, because you don't want to pick up War and Peace and go, right, only another 700 pages to go. The band are driving me mad. Do you know what I mean? This should be relaxing. Now, who is this again? As you meet the 96th character on the 15th page. So it's sometimes a lot easier to deal with something. So I love reading Alice Munro, Raymond Carver, Paul Auster. Stories, there's a touch of the weird about the Raymond Carver story that I've chosen. Anyway, in the story, it's got this wonderful poetic moment. It's closer to poetry, really, as the character is basically saying his wife is leaving him. She's put a note under his bedroom door, and he can hear her moving around downstairs. He says he doesn't dispute any of the things she says in the note, but he knows it's not in her handwriting. The whole thing is what's real and what's not. Anyway, eventually they're outside, she's leaving, I'm going, and they go out through the front doors and it's completely foggy. And on the lawn, horses have broken out of a field nearby and they're eating all their garden. They've basically got a garden full of horses in the fog. So Carver throws you into this sort of poetic image. And then in the middle of this, the police turn up with the owner of the horses. And they're saying to the guy, when the wife's explaining why she's got a suitcase because she's leaving him, saying, hey, no trouble, man, no trouble. And suddenly he's the bad guy. And you're seeing it all through his eyes in a sort of Being John Malkovich kind of way. As the cop takes the wife to the railway station to leave him, he toots the horn as he leaves. And the main character says he actually tooted. And then it's just the word, tooted. That word is gold in a brass age. And that had gone in. I'd reread the story at some point making the record. We made this particular track. And of all the things I was looking for in terms of finding some new terrain in my music, this moment when that track was born was the embodiment of it. I'd only been working with Ben for a month or so. We were working on a completely different song. I'd done all these little guitar figures. I popped out to make a cup of tea, came back and he'd looped them into this little loop, which forms the beginning of that particular tune. And I just started to play a set of chords on top and sing. And within moments, this song was just being born. And I had the hairs on the back of my neck standing up. And at the end of about 4 or 5 hours of just solid making, being absolutely in the moment, we just came out and he said, I'm going to save it. What should I call it? And I just said, Gold in a Brass Age. So it wasn't like a predetermined thing. It's the music of the phrase, the sort of cadence of the words. And obviously, it's an obvious literal translation. You'd say something marvelous and wonderful and rare in a world of meaningless noise. So I'm not making such heady claims for my but we're definitely living in a world of meaningless noise. Whether what I've made is something marvelous and rare, I don't know, but I just love the sound of it. It sounds, the words sound like a trumpet blast. So for those reasons.
I think the record certainly has a luster to it, which I think makes that apposite. What about that process then? It does sound almost alchemical. You're talking about chopping up some of your processes and kind of starting again, being innovative and working with Ben, and this fact that it must be great that you can have one of those hairs on the back of your neck moment just from nowhere. Is it a bit of alchemy? Is it chance? So, I mean, obviously, you've got a great creative idea at the core of it, but is there a bit of luck, just coincidence sometimes, that drives these moments?
Of course. And then, of course, the only equation that matters is that the more you put your chance, yourself in the way of chance, the more likely something good is going to happen. So it's risk. And the tang of the unknown has become something that's become absolutely essential to me. I've always wondered about pushing my music out into different places, but suddenly I've lost all weight and care and inhibition, and but in a good way. And I see that my default position has sort of become one of trying to do something in a way I've never done it before. So I found this incredible website, for example, where there are all these sound artists archiving both urban and rural sounds. So the cracking of ice on a Canadian lake, for example, the rushing of water, a culverted stream off the Holloway Road in 1982, 1985, 1992, whatever. There are people actually documenting all this. Fantastic things like drilling under the Spaghetti Junction in Birmingham. And you just listen to these noises and they sound sort of vaguely orchestral already. And the wonderful thing about technology that's so enabling, I mean, I could rant about it in the opposite direction and all the corrosive effects of it, but one astounding thing is just how easy it is to make an instrument out of any sound now. And that's half of what we did in the studio, was rather than literally take a guitar tape, we'd take the guitar and then take the overtone of a note and use that to try and then reconstruct the chord sequence. It's so painfully done, but worth it in the end, because what you get is this ethereal, odd instrument that sounds like a relative of what you were doing, but it's taken you to another place. You're literally standing in another land. And from there, I survey and I look for the images that I'm going to sort of populate this little zone with. And that's really my process now. And I've become addicted to it. And I, as I say, I'm inquiring into all these sort of field recordings and making my own. And I can just see further and further sort of tributaries branching off. It's almost like an impossible realm of ideas that I can't go down them all. I can't take all the paths least trodden. But that's sort of where I am. And yet, I think underpinning all that, as I said at the very beginning, my melodic instincts will always prevail. Mm. I'll want to tell a story and I'll want to connect. So even if I'm being deliberately evasive in terms of taking any sort of narrative line or autobiographical line, which I've been very hard on in the last couple of records in particular, I still think the story comes through in the end, because your editorial choices and your sonic choices and the music of the words that entrance you, that you choose to use, all tell something about exactly the way that your brain is working at a certain time. When I stand back from this record, it's still a perfect document of the last couple of years. So that was a long rambling answer.
I just wanted to ask you, you talk there about the technology, the computer coming back as you describe it, but there's still a fascination which people will recognise from a lot of your work with the natural world. And you were talking about natural sounds and this sort of thing. And there's butterfly motifs in the artwork. And I, as a sort of keen lepidopterist, David, I felt obligated to ask you about this, because I know that's something you're really interested in. Can we go a bit butterfly into a bit of butterfly and moth nerdery for a moment?
Yeah, you're going to outflank me instantly, because I'm an absolutely rank amateur at the very beginning of my moth bothering.
Well, so. No, it's my grandfather discovered a butterfly species in Papua New Guinea, David. Little thing you...
Wow, fair
probably
play. What's it called?
Wouldn't have been expected. His name was Calderara, so it's Calderari something. And I can't actually remember. But it's so big that when the first Western voyagers came there, they shot them with crushed walnut shells out of a blunderbuss.
Wow.
Because the butterflies were
enormous.
A foot a nice with their tails and all this kind of
that
thing.
That in itself is a short story.
waiting to happen. But tell me a bit about you, that. Well, even if it's rank amateurism, why? Is it because there's something weird and quicksilver and ephemeral about butterflies and moths that's really interesting to you?
I love every aspect of the natural world. Seals, eddying currents, the grasses on the dunes. I've got a small place on the dunes in Norfolk we go down to, which is weirdly like the polar opposite of where I was brought up in Wales. The sort of 45 degree trees blasted by sort of Atlantic gales. And then you've got this very different flat landscape, which sort of atomizes everything. You kind of just dissolve into the sky. You've got this enormous sky, enormous empty beach. Anyway, I'm a keen bird watcher, again, very, very much an amateur one. And I live on the edge of a huge nature reserve, which links with other nature reserves all the way down the North Norfolk coast. It's a phenomenal place for watching wildlife. They all trap moths. So because I've got to know the wardens, then you get to see some of these creatures and are absolutely beguiling creatures that you can only see if you trap them at night. You're not going to come across them otherwise. But when we bought our house, the house that we have down there, the day we went to view it, sitting on the gatepost in broad daylight was a poplar hawk moth. But I didn't want to move. We had another little cottage and I was against moving. But I took this as an omen that my wife was right and that we should move to this new house, which was right on the nature reserve. And it was the right move. So right across from exactly where this poplar hawk moth was, I now own the little field that has all the poplar trees in it. So when I trap, I always get tons of poplar hawk moths. Yeah, I mean, when you hit the mother load in sort of end of June, July, I became moth blind. I can only identify them at a certain rate. In the end, I'm just letting them go. I'm just like, go on, fly away. Then you've got the problem of the birds eating them because they sort of cotton on. You think the chaffinch is a sort of friendly little fellow who just sort of hops about doing his thing, but actually they're all avidly watching for any opportunity. And suddenly realising while you're releasing the moths, these things, the birds are just absolutely... There's a glut of sort
you're
of feeding.
A fast food
yeah,
out there.
Totally, yeah. I find that moths, more than butterflies, are even stranger and weirder creatures. And I love the fact that there's this whole world, this nocturnal world that you don't tap into unless you go and find it. Proximity to nature is astonishing. Seeing things from a distance is one thing, but when you get close, if you have a close encounter with a sparrowhawk or a barn owl, which is something I see every time I go down there, I mean, it's a gift. I'm sort of halfway through writing a poem on exactly that theme. I'm not a poet, really, but I've got this, like, waiting is a kind of burning, and the owl is flame-like. This is the beginnings of my poem. I realised the way that it moved its wings, it's sort of slightly flickering, that we just measure time from one sighting to the next. It's a different sort of way of measuring time, one barn owl to the next. Those things are just, it's pure magic. I couldn't be happier than when I'm in close proximity to this stuff or the geese going over. So the moths just form another part of that world, but they're a very new thing for me. The diversity of it, I mean, it's natural selection, evolution, these things, you know these things are real. You can see why God becomes just an easier way of saying it, because it's just the beauty of it and the diversity of it is just staggering. It's staggering. This niche creation, this kind of grass and this type of season, this type of moisture, the moths that go to sleep in October, the ones that wake up in October. Anyway, yeah, and they're obviously an indicative species. So last summer was so hot, there was all kinds of crazy moths flying around. Crazy. Lots of... So I'm obviously way too into it, but this is where you really bring the British public on board. The campaign's going all full blazing now.
I love it. Well, there's a sort of a wonderful elegiac quality, and I think people will recognise those elegies and... I don't know, a measure of melancholia. I know that upset you at the beginning.
No, it didn't but upset I'm gonna, me. I think you're right. I think that's just a part of me.
And it's on a scintillating record, which is out on the 8th of March. It's called Gold in a Brass Age, for reasons discussed. David Gray, fantastic to meet you. Thanks for coming to see us.
Thank you.
Fernando, time for music. What else could we possibly listen to than a track from that forthcoming album from David Gray? This is If 8 Were 9.
Well, that was If 8 Were 9 by David Gray from his upcoming album Gold in a Brass Age. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly here on Monaco 24.
Steffi Arazzi is a designer and author focusing on the clean, optimistic lines of modernist building design. Forward-thinking style that flourished following the Second World War up until the latter parts of the 20th century. And her writing and commentary also looks at how these classics now sit and thrive in today's urban environment.
She's behind the popular blog modernstates.com and the accompanying book series, the latest of which is Modern Estates Europe. It gathers snapshots of life lived day-to-day amid developments such as Vienna's Werkbund State and Atelier 5's Hallen State in Switzerland, and many more. Earlier, Monaco's design editor Nolan Giles spoke with Steffi to hear more about it.
It was kind of a bit crazy because I didn't know anybody that lived anywhere. And yeah, and so I had specific schemes that I wanted to visit. And I used all sorts of methods to try and get in the door. A lot of it was sort of going there and putting leaflets through doors. Or Airbnb was quite good because you could sort of see people's houses and you had to sort of contact them via Airbnb. But it was kind of a bit strange because you couldn't directly communicate. So you just have to sort of say, like, I'm doing this book, this is my name, Google me. And yeah, all sorts of ways of trying to get into people's homes.
I'm stealing ideas here because in Monocle we produce a resident story most issues, and occasionally we will do a larger development, and it's quite difficult to get into people's houses and apartment blocks. You know, you might see this lovely facade from the outside and see some nice photos online, but actually getting in is a trickier...
I know, completely, because when I was telling my friends that I'm doing this, but like, oh, you should go and see this place, you should go to that place. Like, do you know anybody in there? I don't care about it otherwise, unless you know somebody in there. But yeah, so in the end, it was kind of just really random. And basically, if they got back to me, they were in the book.
And maybe let's look at a specific modernist estate in the book. Maybe the Halen Estate in Bern in Switzerland by the architects Atelier 5. This is an absolutely lovely, gorgeous estate, which, you know, many people still live in today and love today. We've featured it in the magazine before. It's kind of set within a kind of a forest on a hillside. What brought you to this estate in particular, first of all?
Well, I've been obsessed about this estate for quite a long time. There's something about literally this massive concrete in the middle of a forest. It's just kind of amazing. And I've looked at pictures for a long time, and I actually live in Camden Estates, so 1970s Camden Estate, which is one of Sidney Cook's. It's actually designed by Benson Forsyth, and it's kind of based, a lot of the plans are based on the Harlan Estate. So I had a sort of interest beyond sort of liking how it looked. I kind of, yeah, it was kind of the link between where I lived and this particular estate.
And I think one of the amazing things about this book is when you look at these spaces, and obviously they've been interpreted in a modern way by young families, like these guys in particular, there's just so much life in these buildings. Obviously, that's kind of helped by the greenery and the, you know, the big expansive windows and balconies, but they just seem like such joyous places to live. I mean, did you get that feeling too when you were exploring a lot of these estates?
A lot of them, not all of them. I mean, this one is a particularly good one. And I, as you say, you know, I think the light in the houses is great. And what was particularly good about this one, it was really, really private inside, but had amazing sort of communal facilities like swimming pools and play area and shops and everything. But there were others. There's a fantastic estate called Walden 7 by Ricardo Bofill in there. And there was, you know, like the pretty much the middle of the whole of the building is really, really dark. You know, a lot of people kind of complain. So I think what was refreshing is that people that I interviewed were actually very honest. They almost didn't know what to expect in terms of my questions. So their guards were down. And so I was happy to listen. It's kind of what I wanted to know was actually the truth. Like, it's not always perfect. You know, what are the faults? You know, what sort of, where do you put your rubbish? Where, you know, the very sort of mundane ins and outs of living in these buildings.
And I'm interested to hear a little bit about the community spirit in these places, because, you know, when they were dreamed up, I imagine a lot of these architects were thinking about building communities in these estates. And one, you know, really beautiful comment is by this lady, Elizabeth Hutier, in Paris. And she's talking about the fact that she's been there for 46 years and there is still a core group of people in that building who are coming together and having dinner or a catch up. I mean, did you hear a lot of that in your travels?
Yeah, it was interesting, actually, because I think a lot of the places that I visited, there was obviously a very initial community when residents first moved in, because they all moved in at the same time and they're all sort of new to the buildings. I think as that sort of went on and they had their families and then moved away, there's sort of been less sense of community. I think a lot of the stories that I heard, which might be just people sort of just being old and slightly negative, is like younger people are less interested in sort of taking part in the community spirit. But I mean, Elizabeth particularly said that, but then she's in her 80s, so I don't know, maybe there is a... But what I found particularly is that the ones where there were families, there was sort of an instant community because the kids would all sort of talk to each other. So there was sort of, you know, they just didn't have any barriers in terms of going into other people's houses and making friends. So yeah, it was the communities in all of them that kind of really was kind of make or break whether they were successful, I think.
And maybe could you share with us some lessons that you've learned from this book I mean, that's a good one to start with, this idea of bringing a community together. How private should a house be when it's within an estate, and how much should you allow for communal spaces and a little bit of overlap between the way that people live their lives in these estates?
Yeah, I mean, it depends how you like to live, I think. I think this is the thing. It's not going to suit everybody. But I think that the schemes that were really successful were the ones that the houses were particularly private. There was an element of community if you wanted. You didn't have to, but it was there if you wanted it. But I think also one of the main things that made them successful was flexibility. So the schemes and the houses that were flexible in terms of they allowed for your family to expand, grow, and then back down again, they seemed to be the ones where people had stayed there and managed. And because they're staying there, obviously there's a sort of stronger communities as opposed to sort of, you know, more of a turnaround of different residents.
And looking at these estates as well, there's a lot of kind of younger families moving into these places. And, you know, you see in London today the popularity of buildings like the Barbican. What is drawing people, I guess, a certain type of people perhaps, away from a brand new build developed specifically for young families in a city and into something like this, which has its challenges? You know, like you were saying before, these buildings aren't perfect. There's probably problems with the drainage. There's probably problems with, you know, old parts of the building. Is it just charm? I mean, what's bringing people back to them?
I think in the UK, there was definitely that where people were making specific choices about living in these sort of schemes, because I think it's two things. I think essentially they're really well-designed spaces and they're often cheaper. I think in Europe, it is different. It's sort of, I interviewed a family in Le Corbusier's Unité d'Habitation, and it was kind of very basic. He was like, well, this is just the same price as any other flat. There was kind of no, like, we live in a Le Corbusier building. It was like, well, this is the amount of space that we need, so why wouldn't we live here? And that was really refreshing, rather than go like, we live in an icon. You know, it was like, it's just a really good space. And then there weren't architects or designers, and, you know, there were scientists. And I think they were just appreciating the fact that it was a good design space.
In the UK, like you were saying before, there is this kind of love for modernist buildings, for these estates. And you were mentioning in France, people were a little bit less enthusiastic. Did you find, I guess, that love for modernism stronger in any other parts of Europe? Or was it similar to that reaction that you had in France?
I think it was generally just a bit more normal than it is here. It wasn't such a big deal. It didn't have that social stigma that it has here. I think generally it was a lot of the estates that I visited initially, a lot of them were social housing. Maybe now they're sort of private. But I think here in the UK, we just, apart from sort of maybe more creative people or architects, are just not into concrete. Where I would say across all of the places that I visited, they were just much more open about it and living in an apartment. I think in the UK, we've got this obsession with living in houses. And I think across everywhere that I visited, there was no complaints. There was sort of it was not a big deal about having a garden or your own door.
And that's just, I guess, how they've kind of grown up in these cities anyway.
I think so. I think it's just a different frame of mind where, you know, I think there was also less of a sort of obsession about climbing up the ladder. I think maybe that's why a lot of these people were sort of second generation. I think in the UK we have this thing where you buy a house then you upgrade, you know, you're sort of like constantly on this sort of ladder of getting better and better. And I don't think there is an obsession with housing being as an asset. It's like, well, it's a home, like why would you sort of constantly move when this is perfectly adequate and you're not sort of necessarily trying to make money out of it, it's just your home. And I think across all of them, I didn't get that obsession about. In fact, I don't think anybody talked about the value of their home at all. And I think they would do here. It would be like, this property was worth this when I bought it and now it's this. And it's, you know, it just wasn't a discussion.
And I'm interested as well in the more experimental housing projects here. So there's the Werkbund Siedlung in Vienna in Austria, where 32 really well-known architects came together and, you know, tried their hand at different models of housing. How did these building experiments kind of work out from your perspective and from what you've learned doing this report?
Yeah, well, I mean, this one in Vienna is a particularly interesting one because, as you say, it was very experimental, and at the time it was done as a sort of housing exhibition. So they built these houses and opened up to huge crowds. And, you know, it was like, wow, you know, and lots of interest. And it was built in the 1930s, even though it had a lot of press coverage. I think they only sold two from the initial sort of opening. And after that, they were hardly able to sell any of them. And it had to be sold to the city of Vienna, who then took them over and went through a period where they were really, really run down. I think, and this is another, I think, a really interesting point, is pretty much all of these schemes are getting to a point where they all need maintenance. They're all sort of, you know, they're sort of 40, 50 years old, and they all need a certain amount of work doing. And the ones in Vienna, which are obviously, you know, super old, they've spent the last sort of 5 years completely renovating them. And that was actually very interesting to see how different countries, or how the different models of how they manage these buildings, how they look after them. And I think particular, you know, differently to how we do it in the UK, all the residents really cared for their buildings a lot more than they do here. I think there was generally more sort of residents community in terms of that everybody wanted to look after the buildings. I think the sort of irony about that is that a lot of these estates are actually listed, which is great, but because of that, they need to be done in a specific way, which means that it's actually really expensive to sort of carry out any of these renovations.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, because, you know, within a city, we're challenged for space, and within that city is housing. And many of these projects are very beautiful examples of modernist architecture. But at the same time, when they do fail, there is that need to use that space in the best possible way. And occasionally that does mean knocking down something that's of architectural merit. How do you view, I guess, housing as a form of architecture, particularly this style of housing, as opposed to, you know, a monument like an opera house or something that really has an iconic position in the city? I mean, these housing estates can be equally iconic, but obviously there's a challenge there if nobody's living in the house and if there's a lot of effort needed to even keep them up.
I think all of them, I think as long as there is an ongoing maintenance, there's no reason for them, you know, not to be still standing in 100 years' time. I think it's a lot of the times the ones which, you know, were very expensive were ones that sort of had been neglected, you know, especially in the UK. You know, it's just sort of this one you're looking at the moment. This is the one in Paris. I mean, that was social housing. And this woman really, really loved where she was living. But I could see that all the windows were rotting. You know, there were really beautiful timber windows, and so it's run by the Parisian council, who are basically saying, okay, we need to replace the windows, and we're going to replace them with UPVC, because this one isn't listed. So I mean, it's sort of interesting. It's like, at what level do you keep up with the times and keep it exactly as it is? I think a really good example of one of these that's been done really well is the Werkbund housing in Zurich. It's a 1930s scheme of houses. And I think it's had sort of renovation works twice in its lifetime. And really generous size houses, beautiful sort of full width glazing. It's Swiss, so I think they've just done everything really, really well. But because it's listed, but they've done everything like it looks as it was, but it's like triple glazing windows, and it's just sort of immaculate. So, but it's expensive. You know, I think the thing is that to do it, it's expensive, but it's got to be cheaper than knocking them down and starting again. It's got to be.
And just finally, a lot of the time we do see books that are really reflecting on this period of modernist architecture and design. In many ways, they are a celebration of that period, and in many ways, yours is too. But like you were saying, you have taken a really honest approach to this. And when there is problems and when there are challenges with these buildings, you're not covering them up. What was the reason and the inspiration to take it this way?
Well, I mean, I've always lived in a purpose-built flat myself. I grew up in a council estate, and I moved to the Barbican when I first came to London, so a very different experience. Obviously that's very well run, but I now live in a sort of ex-council flat, so I'm very aware of the sort of struggles of, and also the pleasures of, living in these kind of communities. And I think I was interested in the stories, and I think I didn't want to make a book that just looked at people's, you know, furniture and glamorized it, because I just wanted to know the reality. And the reason I did the first book was because I was actually looking for a flat for myself, so I started interviewing people, and so that's why I wanted to know, like, you know, what's it actually like to live here. And I think people really responded to that. You know, I think both it makes a more interesting book than something that just looks very, very glossy, and it's real life.
Steffi Arazzi there of Steffi Arazzi Studio, talking to Nolan Giles, and Steffi's book, Modernist Estates Europe, is out now. Head to Steffi's very practically titled webpage, thingsyoucanbuy.co.uk, to pick up a copy. This is the Monocle Weekly. British photojournalist Don McCullen's images over the past 60 years have captured scenes ranging from the horrors of conflict during the Vietnam War to poverty and inner-city life in the heart of the UK. One of the world's greatest living photographers, a retrospective of his work is currently on show at London's Tate Britain.
Earlier, Monaco's Rob Bound headed down to Tate to meet Aisha Meres, assistant curator of contemporary British art, to learn more.
Unusually for an exhibition of contemporary photography, people might assume that, as is the case with lots of contemporary photographers, this work is shipped off and printed by a whole team of other people, but every work in the show is a gelatin silver print which has been printed by McCullen himself in his darkroom in his farmhouse in Somerset, or in Hertfordshire if it was printed in that period. One thing that we're trying to make sure that people understand with this show is that, yes, he's 83 and he's had this hugely varied life and it's getting on in years, but he's as sharp as ever and his skill as a printer is astounding. Like you say, the darkness in his printing, he's often accused of printing a bit too dark, but he shapes that himself in the darkroom. There's a little film in the kind of slip gallery where the shop is just outside the exhibition space, and for the first time ever he allowed cameras into the darkroom, and you can see some of that skill. You can see some of the equipment that he's using that 17-year-olds who just take pictures on iPhones might never have seen anything like that. So we want to get across some of the understanding of that amazing skill as a master printer. But the darkness that you talk about is serious and deep. And even in the landscapes, the kind of lyricism is not romantic, it's Wagnerian. So yeah. The clouds are dark and brooding and the trees are raw, and as Simon, my co-curator, said in the tour, he doesn't go out on sunny days. He waits until it's as grim as possible and he's like, yes, okay, and he gets outside and takes pictures of really grim Somerset, but that's the most beautiful time to him, and that's because of the darkness in his soul. You know, he's going out to take these pastoral scenes, but they're always reminding him of the theatres of war, which he's spent all this time in, all the miners that he's documented in Doncaster and in other places in the north. So all of that is at the forefront of his mind, and it's kind of inescapable, but he uses still life and landscape, printed very darkly, to help him cope with those memories.
And as curators in the darkroom and putting the show together, doing the hang and all the rest of it, was he telling you stories the whole time about what he was doing when and what this was like? And there's an interesting label on one of the pictures in a room themed around it about consent as well, actually. Getting eye contact with the subject, even in a stolen moment, in order to have a sort of unspoken moment of consent from that. I wondered if he talked about that when he was putting the show together, actually physically here in the gallery.
This is something that's really key to Don, is that people understand that he is photographing people. They're not necessarily just subjects of his work, that feeling and emotional awareness is at the very centre of his work. He says that really his photographic equipment is his eyes and his head and his heart. So when he goes out into the field of battle, or when he goes out into places where miners' strikes are happening, he wants to connect with those individuals and understand what's happening to those people. Cornel Kappa, the art historian and curator, talked about this group of concerned photographers, and this was a group of photographers for whom this kind of capacity for empathy was huge. And you can see through Don's portraits and as you say, in the heat of the moment of battle, taking a moment to make eye contact with somebody, so that even if in the heat of battle, the only way he can get consent is implicit through eye contact. He told us lots of stories about photographs he didn't take, which is interesting, where he did go for that eye contact or ask for consent, and it was clear that it was not there, and he didn't take those pictures, and that he would come back and not say anything to the commissioning editors, because obviously then he'd get the boot. Why did he not take that picture? But that's something that's so key to why the work is so strong, because you can see the connection with the photographic subjects, whether it's in the homeless communities of East London, where he has specific stories about specific characters, and he makes these portraits that pay testament to the harsh realities of life for these people, but then also that connection that he feels. So consent is really important to him, but you know, it's conflict photography is a tricky area ethically. But it's something that plagues him and worries him, and if you'll excuse the pun, he has a conflicted relationship with with photojournalism.
And I guess a lot of people will see nobility on these walls and struggle and all the rest of it. I think it's very beautiful as well. That's not a mad thing to say, but do you see a lot of beauty here as much as the pain and the meaningfulness of it?
I think there will always be a problem with the aestheticization of conflict images. There are things that you can see in terms of framing and composition that he's doing with photography, what Goya did with paint, that he's taking light meter readings even while he's being shot at to make sure that compositionally that image is going to stick in your mind and that you as the viewer will linger for a little bit longer so that it's there and you can't, he says, you have to bear witness, you cannot look away. And that's something that he's trying to encourage you to do. And again, with the printing, though the subject matter is of primary concern to him, again, it's making sure that these prints are of the best quality, that the tone is correct, that compositionally, you know, you can see in some of the images of Vietnam that are taken in the heat of battle, he has this kind of Catholic thing in the back of his mind from growing up as a poor Catholic boy in Finsbury Park, that he sometimes has these almost iconographic imagery with mother and child and with wounded Marines in Vietnam looking like Jesus being taken down from the cross. So although he's not necessarily, that's not his primary concern, he has this innate ability to be able to frame things in such a way that, yes, there is a kind of uncomfortable beauty in his work.
There is something of reportage done with the skills of an artist rather than simply someone bearing witness. There is something, as you say, kind of, I guess, innate about that. Does that kick off a bit of a conversation amongst you as curators, perhaps, as well, about, you know, truth and reportage and staging and lighting and all the rest of it? Because no people, it seems, have been arranged for these photographs, but there's always an idea of if something's too perfect an image, is it a true image? Did that ever cross your curatorial mind?
Well, actually, one example that's the exception that proves the rule is that there is one work in the show that he put together himself and freely admits to that. And it's good that he admits to this one and that we know that that's the only one. In Vietnam, there was a young Vietnamese soldier who died and some Marines were just looting through his stuff using not anthropologically kosher words for this man. And Don said that that moment, that was the only time he felt like he wanted to make a composition. And he got his belongings and he laid them out in front of him like a kind of memento mori, still life sort of situation, with pictures of his wife and his belongings in front of him. So there are those sort of uncomfortable moments of composition, but that's the thing that's key, is Don's emotional awareness, that's the thing that is at the centre of all of this, whether it's conflict or social documentary work, is that he's giving a voice to those individuals and it's individual focused.
Aisha Mehr is there, speaking to Robert Bound about the Don McCullin exhibition currently on show at Tate Britain in London until the 6th of May. You are with the Monocle Weekly.
And there, Fernando, we must all but leave it. What a show we've had this week. As we always say, light and shade, fascinating photography, an absolute delight to welcome David Gray to the studio. What a gent.
And it was fascinating hear you both discussing about butterflies and moths. I mean, he was so excited about it. We need
he
to
was
tell
very,
listeners.
Very excited. He's a keen lepidopterist, as am I. Just a great new record. As I said, it's hard to believe several things. One, that White Ladder is almost 20 years old. Secondly, What a youthful-looking man masquerading, surely, as a 50-year-old.
And it's a great pop song, especially a Tai Chip. It's such a nice electronic beats, and yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Great to meet David. Great to meet all of our guests, and I hope you enjoyed it too. Let's thank the people that made it happen. Behind the Glass, the programme was produced by Tom Hall and Augustine Machellari, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Weekly will be back again at the same time next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Goodbye, and thanks for listening.